Okay. We really want to understand accretion flows. Actually, I would really like to understand black hole accretion flows, but I know there are planet people in the audience as well. We want to understand the accretion flow. In black holes in particular, we know that we can use it to probe strong gravity. We know that we need that accretion flow on the supermassive black holes to do us AGN feedback, to do the large-scale structure in the universe. We really need to understand this stuff. If the answer from the simulations is, well, we need to do radiative GR MHD calculations of a global disk simulation, we're going to be waiting 10 plus years. And I have a short attention span. So how do we get answers faster? Well, I think the answer is we calculate what can be calculated in parts of these kind of simulations. We don't have to run full GR radiative MHD if we're interested in what's happening in a UV bright disk at 40 gravitational radii. What we need is hydrodynamics, what we need is atomic physics. So I think we should be breaking the problem down into kind of bits that we can do, running simulations that focus on one or two aspects of the physics, rather than having to throw everything in a big GR radiative MHD simulation that's going to take forever, even on the biggest computers. So if we want to do AGN feedback, we need to think about disk winds. And we know something about disk winds. We know we can do thermally driven winds. We know we can do UV line driven winds. And we know we can do Eddington winds when we go super Eddington. So we could actually get part of this radiative mode AGN feedback by making proper models of these sorts of winds. Whatever's left over, we desperately need magnetic fields for, but we can't even say what we need magnetic fields for until we've quantitatively done models of the things we can calculate. So I guess my bottom line is, let's calculate what we can calculate. But we can't calculate these winds unless we understand what the spectral energy distribution is doing. A super Eddington wind you get when you've gone super Eddington. How do you know you've gone super Eddington? You look at your spectral energy distribution and you add it up. A UV line driven wind, so there's our continuum driven wind. Yes, you need to go Eddington. You'll go Eddington first at the inner regions of the disk. Those are the brightest ones. That's where you'll power your wind from. You need to know what your spectral energy distribution has done. Has it gone super Eddington? For a UV line driven wind, what you need is ultraviolet. Ultraviolet opacities, you absorb a line, you absorb the momentum in the line, so you start it moving, so you shift it. So it's shifted to a nice clean bit of the continuum that it can also absorb and absorb that momentum. So it accelerates a bit further and further and further and further, and you get this UV line-driven wind. But that you need UV for, so you need to know your spectral energy distribution. So, when you look at a spectral energy distribution, this is the kind of Elvis et al. Standard quasar spectral energy distribution, it's complex. So in here, I've got from radio through to X-ray, I should probably use the laser pointer because I can't reach, radio through to X-ray energies. Here you've got the big blue bump, here you've got the X-rays, infrared torus, something going on in the radio. So it's complex. It's not just a standard disk model. Often people will do calculations for standard disk models and say, oh, but this can't work. The data often show you that the spectral energy distribution is not a standard disk model. So when we're doing these winds, we need to put in realistic spectral energy distributions. It would help if we understood where they came from, but at the bottom line, if we put in a realistic spectral energy distribution and calculate with that, we'll get better answers than if we said it should be a disk when it's plainly not. So one of the ways to go is to scale up what we see in the stellar mass black holes. When we look at black hole binaries, the nice thing with black hole binaries is they change. So you can actually watch the accretion flow change on timescales of days, weeks, months. And we know there's this big transition in in the spectrum we see from the accretion flow. It goes from low luminosities, you get this Comptonization dominated spectrum that goes out to maybe 100 keV, and at higher mass accretion rates, it tends to know something about a disk, even if it's not completely given by the kind of disk equations. So by looking at black hole binaries, you see very clearly that there are two kinds of solutions to your accretion flow equations, one of which has something that looks very like a thin disk, but you see these mainly at high luminosities. So it's got some bit of a corona on top of it. And then you get these very different types of flows at lower luminosities, which look like something like an ADAF, probably also threaded by magnetic field, though, which can launch you a jet. So we know that in black hole binaries, we've got these two accretion flow solutions, and something complicated happens when you make transitions between the two or when you go close to Eddington. So this is what we have. So if we scaled this up to active galaxies, what's happened? Well, the main thing that's happened, of course, is we've got a much bigger mass black hole. With a bigger mass, you actually have a lower disk temperature. So your disk temperature is now peaking in the ultraviolet. And that is clearly giving us a break in the physics. In black hole binaries, what matters is plasma physics. Everything's ionized, there's not much opacity in anything other than electron scattering. And so this is a big break in the physics. Atomic physics is going to come and bite us. And so this is something we really need to think about. Obviously, we've also got a larger range in mass as well. The smallest kind of AGN, with maybe a few by 10 to the 5 solar masses, the biggest is a few by 10 to the 10. This is a range in mass of a factor of 10 to the 5. We are going to notice changing mass by that order of magnitude. The black hole binaries, they're all within a factor of 2 of 10 solar masses. That's incredibly homogeneous. This is not. We might also get a bigger range in spin as well, but I don't want to talk too much about that today. So the key thing here is we're not going to be looking at a single parameter. Often observers will say, okay, we've got luminosity, but luminosity depends on mass and mass accretion rate. And if I have this bigger range in mass, then I really have to think about what sort of mass I'm doing. But this at least two parameter family, I would call it an opportunity, because we know we have a zoo of AGN types. They look at optical line ratios, you can classify AGN into a multitude of different names, I never know where I am. So in some sense, this is an opportunity to try and understand something about this mess of different types of AGN. Where do they come from? What are they telling us? But when you talk about the kind of different types of AGN, people instantly think of unification schemes that depend on inclination, because we know there's some sort of obscuring torus in the equatorial plane that gives you an inclination-dependent view of what you're seeing. So from now on, I want to ignore anything that I think is at all obscured, because we have enough problems looking straight down. So if we're looking straight down, then what do we see? If we take our black hole binary models and we scale them, what would we expect? So all we're doing, remember, is taking our UV, our X-ray disk temperature that you see in the stellar mass black holes, and we're dragging it down into the ultraviolet. So we're just doing this. So that's the prediction you get from scaling black hole binary models. This is what your SCD should look like. So the optical is down here. This is the ultraviolet. This is the kind of classic X-ray band. And so what you see is you've got a range of spectral energy distributions from a single mass object at different mass accretion rates. Then this is predicting that the intrinsic spectral energy distribution will change dramatically with L over L ed. And again, this is an opportunity, because this will give you changing optical line ratios and will help you understand that mess of AGN types. So if we go through some of that mess of AGN types and we try and select things of roughly equal mass but different mass accretion rate, then the lowest mass accretion rate, you'll have the liners, and then as you go up, this is where this transition is that we see in black hole binaries. As you go up in mass accretion rate, you get to the Steiferts. They kind of sit somewhere on here and standard kind of quasars, and then you go up still further, you get the narrow line Seyfert ones. So how do we get, and what sort of things do we then predict if we take our black hole binary models and we compare them to a scaled up kind of AGN? At low mass accretion rates in the black hole binaries, we see this hot flow type of solution, something a bit like an ADAF. It's also the one that has some sort of radio structure in it. So these are actually kind of quite bright in radio. They have a compact jet. It's not going very fast. It's only a bulk Lorentz factor of 1.5, but still you expect radio emission from this. And because you've replaced the inner disk by this hot flow, you don't expect strong UV emission. Data around here is difficult. There's a lot of orders of magnitude on this side. The blue is kind of a compilation of liner spectral energy distributions, and the red is that Elvis et al. Radio quiet SED. The ultraviolet is here. And there's a lot less ultraviolet emission in the liners than in a standard bright quasar, and there is a similarly more radio in the liners than in the standard bright quasars. So that's looking okay. That's kind of doing what you might expect for a scaled up black hole binary model put up against a low Eddington fraction AGN. Now let's get to the fun stuff. Let's turn up the knob, because we want to do these things when they're bright, because when they're bright, we can see them, and when they're bright, they have the most luminosity output, and that's going to do the most damage to your host galaxy. So let's go for a standard quasar now. The models that we scale up from black hole binaries tell us that's where you get actually something that looks like a thin disk. So let's look at some data. Here's some data. Here's the optical UV. This is HST COS, so I'm not sure whether you'd call this bi UV. It's getting quite blue. Here's soft X-rays. Here's hard X-rays. And you look at this and you think, yeah, it looks pretty disk-dominated to me. But we know the mass of this thing and we know its mass accretion rate, so we can put a standard disk on it. And when we do that, it misses horribly. I mean, really misses horribly. In the black hole binaries, we do see disks that go into the X-ray region and have the sorts of temperatures we expect when we're looking at high mass accretion rates. This one is turning down in the UV. This has been known for a long time. It has some X-ray emission. We're never that surprised when there's a bit of an X-ray corona. We had this in black hole binaries in these states. But this X-ray corona is pointing, the spectrum's pointing up at 2 to 10, and we don't see that in the black hole binaries. When they're disk-dominated, the X-ray spectrum always points down. This thing does point down, but it doesn't point at the X-ray spectrum. There's kind of a bend. We call this the soft X-ray excess. And actually, you get a much better fit if you just join the dots. We call it, like I said, we call it the soft X-ray excess. Well, what is it? What is it? Well, firstly, let's try and fit it. So you can fit it, like in those models, with a disk that's normal up to some point, and then kind of the disk kind of just loses its ability to thermalize properly. And so instead of getting blackbody emission, you get color temperature corrected blackbody emission, and in the limit, that goes to thermal comptonization at low temperatures and high optical depths because it's all of the disk. And then you have some little corona in the middle. So you could do this, and these models fit very well. But it's not the only way to make this soft X-ray excess. Another way to do it is to say, well, that hard X-ray corona is illuminating the disk, And illumination gives us X-ray reflection. And X-ray reflection, if the material is not completely ionized, has a there's a lot of soft X-ray lines and an increased reflection efficiency down at low energies. Soft X-ray lines are all a bit obvious, whereas that soft X-ray excess is very smooth. So then you have to smear these lines. So this means that you use the Doppler shift and strong gravity to really smear out those lines. And so you take it from something that's obvious to something that's much smoother. If you do that, you need really impressive smearing because those lines are really obvious. So now we've got two ways of making that soft X-ray excess. One way that says the disk has gone a bit kind of funny and lost it, and these fit the X-ray spectra very well. Here's this disk lost it. Here's our corona. And here's reflection from the torus. It's narrow. I don't want you to think about that for the moment. And that fits the data. Or you can do strong X-ray reflection from partially ionized, very inner disk. You have to do some really funky GR to make this smeared enough, but you can do it. And it fits the data. So what do? We've got two very different physical models, both of which fit the data. Well, actually, they both fit a small region of the data. If we extend our band path and go up to higher energies, which we can now do with even more sensitivity than this one because of New Star, when we do this, we can really start to tell the difference. Because in a reflection-dominated model, the power law was going down, reflection dominates, and it always has to turn down, and you miss the high-energy data quite badly. Whereas in this intrinsic disk gone bad on you, then this was thermal comptonization at very low temperature, then this keeps on going and goes through the data. So the disk has done something funny. And I think this is more of an opportunity. So here's more data which you can fit in this way. Everything, these fit the data. These disks gone bad on you fit data where you're roughly at 10% of Eddington onto a 10 to the 8 solar mass black hole. But the big question is surely why? Why has the disk gone bad on us? Well, if you look at an SED of these sorts of flows, this is an extreme version. What you see is this downturn is happening in the ultraviolet. The UV bright region of the disk somehow looks strange. Oh, I wonder why. There's a lot of atomic physics that goes on in the UV bright region of the disk that hasn't really been incorporated very well into disk models. If we do some hydrodynamic disk models, where we actually put in UV opacities, we allow it to do UV line driving from the photosphere, maybe the hard X-rays kill it, so you have a failed UV line-driven disk wind, it smacks down onto the photosphere, maybe you get lots of shocks, maybe it's a bit of a mess, or maybe it's the disk instability trying to make a... There's a lot of physics in UV atomic opacities that has not been incorporated into standard disk models. If we did, maybe we'd understand the soft X-ray excess. So, scaling from black hole binaries to standard quasars broke horribly for reasons that I think are more connected to UV atomic opacities than they are connected to GR-MHD, which is good news because I think they're more calculable in a reasonable timescale. But not by me, but by some of the people in this room. So now let's go one step higher now. So we've done low mass accretion rate, low Eddington fractions, middle Eddington fractions. Now let's go towards Eddington. And when you go towards Eddington, these are the narrow line Seyfert ones, and they come in two types. There are simple narrow line Seyfert ones, and there are complex narrow line Seyfert ones. And they look pretty much the same in the optical and UV. The difference comes in their X-ray behavior. One set have kind of smooth spectra and variability that's just kind of factors of two, and the other set have quite dramatic X-ray spectra, and their variability is quite dramatic, life's hard enough already, let's stick with the simple ones and try and understand what we're seeing. So simple narrow line Seyfert ones look like this. We can use the same model, join the dots, and the thing you see here now is that you're actually disk dominated. So people often tell you AGN all look the same. Really, they don't. So here we have some very different types of spectral energy distributions that don't kind of stop here and join to here. There's a huge soft X-ray wall that you see. So we can use the same models, and you can fit the data with these join the dots models, disk gone bad on you. And the thing that changes is the region at which the disk goes bad on you gets much smaller. So that's where we were before. That's what you need for the narrow line Seyfert ones. It's much more like a standard disk.
What's the green curve?
The green curve is the disk gone bad on you region. That's where it comes out as thermal comptonization rather than a black body. Low temperature thermal comptonization, where the disk itself has lost the ability to thermalize the emission into something that looks like a black body. So let's look at this in more detail. Here's an object I think Omar's going to talk about afterwards, where I'm looking now just at this soft X-ray region, just at this enormous soft X-ray region. These narrow line Seyfert ones are typically very low mass, few by 10 to the 6 solar masses, typically high Eddington fraction around unity. And if you just put a standard black body disk model at these parameters, then you get something that looks like this. So really, most of this soft X-ray huge wall that you see is what you would have predicted to see from standard black body disk models. There is a little bit of something dipping off the end here that you need something else for, but the majority of the energy is coming out, as you would expect, for a disk-dominated spectrum, like we see in the black hole binaries. And then there's your standard little weak hard X-ray tail that you see in black hole binaries. In other words, I've made you a spectrum like this blue line in these local narrow line Seyfert ones. It's almost it's disk dominated. This looks like standard add up your black body disk emission, like in the black hole binaries in the high soft state. And it's got very weak hard X-ray emission. Let's think what we said earlier about winds, UV line driven disk winds. UV line driven disk winds, the real requirement to get them going is that you shouldn't irradiate them by lots of hard X-rays. These spectral energy distributions are intrinsically very X-ray weak. Now, this local narrow line Seyfert one I just showed you has very low mass. And at low mass, you have quite high disk temperature. And so this disk is peaking in the far ultraviolet soft X-ray region. That in itself is enough to over-ionize the UV opacity you need for UV line-driven disk winds. But if I went to a much higher mass quasar, if I went to a 10 to the 9 solar mass quasar, my disk goes down and peaks now in the ultraviolet region of the spectrum, but is still X-ray weak. I cannot think of a better spectral energy distribution from which to power a UV line-driven disk wind. So these spectral energy distributions tell me that at moderate Eddington fractions of 0.1, 0.2, where the standard quasars are, I've got a lot of hard X-rays that would kill my UV opacity. Any UV line-driven wind is going to have a failed time. But these Eddington AGN, this is where I expect the most powerful winds. That's really interesting if you come from an X-ray viewpoint, because from an X-ray viewpoint, we have the ultra-fast outflows, which, funnily enough, we see from objects that pretty much have spectral energy distributions like this red line. They are the most massive around Eddington X-ray weak objects. PDS 456 has the strongest ultra-fast outflow that we know of in the local universe. It has beautiful very high ionization material outflowing at 0.2 the speed of light. So these are different spectra on different times, taken at different times. You see there's variability in the line, but there's also variability in the X-ray continuum. This material that gives you the line, this is so highly ionized that it would have no opacity down here. But plainly, there is a lot of change down here. So what you need, actually, to make this is a clumpy wind. You need the wind to have gone clumpy, and I don't think that's a surprise because most winds are clumpy. So if you have cool clumps embedded in a hot wind, then you can make the X-ray spectra that you see from this classic ultra-fast X-ray absorber. You have the cool clumps giving you the variability down at lower X-ray energies. You have the hot phase of the wind giving you these resonance lines. This is being pushed. You see the other biggest, most powerful outflow is not in the local universe, but in a gravitationally lensed quasar, where you see, let's do this. So the top one was this local quasar, where you see this beautifully strong absorption line and some structure up at slightly higher energies. This is a redshift 4 quasar, and it has, again, a 0.2C outflow in its resonance line, a bit more structure here that you can make from the cool clumps in a hot wind. And here's the spectral energy distribution of this redshift 4 quasar, and you can see the data. Here's the data on the disk part. It's UV very bright, it's X-ray very weak. Is this a UV line-driven wind? Because that spectral energy distribution kind of shouts, I'm a UV line-driven wind. But these X-ray absorbers we see are so highly ionized, they can't possibly be pushed by UV. At any rate, they can't be pushed by UV when we see them. But disks are disks, and so you could push something, you could accelerate it in a UV zone close to the disk, and then as it rises up, you can ionize it, and maybe what we're seeing is the ionized face of this more complex wind. Maybe we can actually have UV line driving make us these ultra-fast X-ray outflows, as well as bowels. So then in the last 2 minutes, let's push it even further and let's go super Eddington. What happens when a flow goes super Eddington? Well, here's one. So this is one of the simple narrow line Seyfert ones from the optical and UV data. When you know the black hole mass, then you use this data and you can get the mass accretion rate. The mass accretion rate that's inferred from the optical here is something like 13 times the Eddington limit with zero spin. So I've already put the efficiency in. So if this material had a standard disk spectrum, it would look like this red line for zero spin, and it would look like the blue line for maximal spin. Either way, you can see you are dramatically over-predicting the amount of energy you actually have. Your observed energy is quite a lot less than that. We are losing a lot of power here. Winds, and here we can do them just by Eddington and or advection. Here's another one, another pretty one. You measure the mass accretion rate here. It's 12 or 13 times that required to produce you Eddington on a zero spin black hole. And again, you've got a lot less than that. You can quantify, how much power am I losing? This is the radiative power. The rest is either going down the black hole or being used to power a wind. But if it's used to power a wind, then these have winds as well. They'll probably be clumpy. Maybe this gives us how to explain these complex narrow line Seyfert ones. If we have a super Eddington wind that's gone clumpy on us, maybe the complex ones are the ones where we're looking at a bit of a higher inclination angle and things have gone nasty on us. That's highly controversial because the complex narrow line Seyfert ones are the ones where these dramatic X-ray spectra are used in these extreme gravity relativistic reflection models. So let's look at one of them. And here we have 1HO707, but it's got some optical and UV spectra, so we can use that to measure the mass accretion rate. And when you do that, the mass accretion rate, assuming the relativistic reflection models are correct, down here they need maximal spin. But if you have maximal spin, then the same mass accretion rate onto the black hole gives you a more super Eddington flow. And actually you get that this flow for maximum spin is 270 times the Eddington limit. So, this object must be powering a wind. Must be powering a wind, in which case I think these features may well be more from the wind than from just relativistic reflection alone. You can fit the same wind models that you fit to PDS456, you can fit to 1HO707, and they fit. So let's wind it up. We've got a zoo of AGN out there, and we must have differences in mass, mass accretion rate, spin, and inclination. That's the set we have to play with. Yeah, there'll be magnetic fields, hysteresis, but first we should figure out what the three, four parameters we can do something with, what they do. We can scale from black hole binaries to AGN, and the big thing is that that moves the disk into the ultraviolet. Atomic physics is going to be much more important and break the scaling. Maybe this produces the soft X-ray excess that we see that dominates the spectrum of broadline Seyfert ones. In broadline Seyferts, it dominates the energetics. We need to understand this. At lower Eddington fractions, actually, scaling works because you're still dealing with plasma physics. Liners look like low hard state black hole binaries, more or less. Narrow line Seyfert ones, actually at much higher mass accretion rates, they look quite like disk-dominated black hole binaries. They're disk-dominated with weak X-rays. And if you do that for high mass, really high mass, 10 to the 9 solar masses at Eddington, then they're UV bright and X-ray weak, and you'll get a UV line-driven disk wind. And when you go super Eddington, of course, you get winds. What a surprise. So this is my wish list, and I'm going to leave it there. Thank you.
Very nice. Could you please go back to your conclusions? So the second last point, I just would like to make a comment that we have already computed structures for exactly this configuration and discussed these effects in 2004, and indeed.
You didn't have an inner disk.
Huh?
So you didn't, if it's the 2004 paper, don't you stop at 60 gravitational radii?
It depended on the mass. The simulations were designed in such a way that the domain was always to capture the UV part of the disk. So what you suggested here has been already confirmed by detailed calculations.
Fantastic.
A comment and a question. The comment is for that very spectrum. Of course, 1HO707. We have reverberation.
Indeed, we do.
Data.
Okay.
Which is.
Can I talk about that? That would be great. So, what you get in reverberation? So these models predict that if you have variability, then you'll see the X-ray source vary, and a little time later, you'll see the relativistic reflection vary. And so, in models where this spectrum is dominated by relativistic reflection, then what you should see is you should see the bit here where you can still see something about the intrinsic source vary, and a little time later you should see the reflection vary. That's interesting because we really see this, but we see it in a context where that's not what we generally see. In general, for lower frequency variability, what you see is the soft X-rays go first, and then the hard X-rays go.
Yeah,
and in a relativistic model like this, you can't do that.
But
so you need both.
The continuum itself clearly has structure. I mean, we know that.
So absolutely.
If you take the temporal structure of the continuum and the temporal structure of the reverberation, you can reproduce.
You have very similar reverberation patterns in this source, in the simple narrow line safer one, but the time scales you see are about 10 times larger, which that's very surprising. But what you can do is you can build a full spectral variability model for this simple narrow line safer one, and then you can throw occultations across it. And because you've put correlated variability, it dilutes the timescales, and you go from that frequency lag to diluting it down, and I can quantitatively show you that it works.
So my question, which may be a little more interesting, is, so in Santa Barbara, let me channel Ski Antonucci here. So in all these models, the one thing you're not challenging at all is that the optical data are from the disk and are telling you something about M dot. How do we absolutely know that's true?
Okay. So if I go back to this one, how do you absolutely know that that's a disk? Well, it looks awfully like a disk. Except when it doesn't. Okay. Then make me a model for what the outer parts of the disk are doing. Because I think that looks like an outer disk. And it fits to a model of an outer disk. And it varies like an outer disk, which means it doesn't really vary much at all. So there was a recent paper, a U on it, looking at the Swift variability in the optical and UV. And one of the things you clearly see is that the narrow line safer ones in general have very little optical UV variability, which is what you expect from a disk, because actually disks are quite stable. The only place you see high optical UV variability are the spectral energy distributions that are the standard quasars. Okay, and then this is really interesting because, let's go for a standard quasar. The standard quasars have higher mass black holes, so these should not vary faster than the lower mass black holes, but they do. And the reason they do, of course, is because the disk isn't a standard disk anymore. Someone needs to calculate these things. Let's calculate these things.
So, Chris, very interesting. One of the problem is, of course, that the crucial bit of your spectrum is unobservable.
Yes.
But the nice thing about AGN is, of course, that we can see them at high redshift. So what would you predict that we should see in the high redshift cases
where
the UV becomes observable?
This was a high redshift case, and it doesn't actually become very observable because you've got the Lyman alpha forest. So in here, our data here, they are getting us the top part of the disk emission, but they're Lyman alpha forested, and you have to dig. This is redshift 4, but you can get a handle on the spectral energy distribution at the peak. Firstly, because it's redshift 4, and secondly, because it's a very high mass, so that puts the disk spectrum down into the ultraviolet. So I did some detailed reverberation mapping. The new 5548 campaign is just amazing in that it gives us data that's worth really making full spectral models for. So in this particular object, what you've got is light curves that go from 10 keV all the way down to R-band. They've got HST, they've got Swift, and they've got decent sampling. It's just wonderful. And so what you want to do is you want to look at the hard X-ray variability and look at that reverberating off the disk to do disk reverberation. But like we were just saying, in order to get optical, they pick objects that have big optical variability. So they pick actually the most extreme low luminosity AGN where the disk is least like a disk that you have ever seen. So you get numbers that don't look like a disk. Oh, I'm shocked. So we did some full spectral modeling, and you see a lot of hard X-ray variability on timescales of days. And that's interesting because the UV optical light curves are very smooth on timescales of like 20 days. And reverberation lags on timescales that it smooths. The lag is 1 day, but the smoothing timescale is 20. You cannot do that from just light travel time. So in fact, that tells you that the hard X-rays that are dominating the energy budget can't be illuminating the disk because none of that fast variability goes through. And I think that tells you that this region that I would like to make the soft X-ray access from has a slightly extended scale height and is kind of shielding this bit of the disk from the hard X-ray variability that would otherwise give me fast UV variability. But these, fundamentally, these reverberation campaigns that Rick Edelson and Brad Peterson have been putting together, they get us somewhere new because the weight of data is now just incredible. We need these campaigns to really do this.
I mean, as a comment on that, the quasar microlensing has shown similar results in sources that are not at all like these, right, and find compatible results.
In which case, where's yes. Would you like to make a comment?
Yes. Come and see my pointer I just put up this morning. I think if you abandon the blackbody assumption, you can get disks which appear bigger. It's basically scattering in the atmosphere, putting out the light at shorter wavelengths than you expect from a blackbody. So at a given wavelength, you're emitting out to larger radii, so the disk looks bigger. So.
Sure, but then it's not a disk. That's all I'm saying. That the
I don't. If its spectral energy distribution looks like this, it's not a disk. but yes, the ones they do with the quasars are much more like the narrow line Seyfert ones that are a bit more kind of disky.
Yeah, it's the same. My question was following up on what Paul asked before. I mean, what's the best? Is that one on the right the best case where you see closest to the peak? I mean, is there one where you actually see any see the turnover itself?
Okay, so the one I really like, this is Chichuan Jin's work. This is the most amazing object that you've never heard of, because it's the column density through our galaxy is less than 10 to the 20. It is less than 10 to the 20. So the HST here, if I just showed you the raw data, the absorption correction starts coming in kind of here. This is ROSAT at 0.1 kV. It starts coming in here. What you see on this picture is what you get. There's less than an order of magnitude lost in the unobservable region. This is the spectrum of this source. And it's amazing.
But my question is, you have a mass there, 7 times 10 to the 6. Where is that problem, and how big are the uncertainties on it, and how is that possible to conclude?
Okay, so the best guess, if you take it from, we took the mass from H beta, and did it several ways, you get somewhere between 5 and 10 by 10. A conservative range would be 5 by 10, 5 to 10 by 10 to the 6. So there's no way to make this not super Eddington.
So I had one one sort of more commenty thing, which is, I mean, so it looked like you were particularly clearly invoking line-driven winds, UV line-driven winds for the sort of roughly Eddington sources, right? Because they have the nice UV bright SEDs. I guess sort of if you're close to Eddington, you know, the amount of extra push you need from the lines is not very much. I mean, I wonder, maybe Daniel might want to say something about this. It seems like that's barely a line-driven wind. I mean, it's almost a continuum-driven wind, right?
I think in some sense, yes, it's a UV line-driven, continuum-driven wind. But still, if you're invoking UV line driving, because the opacity is so much bigger, I think you'll have a structurally different wind, won't you? Daniel.
I everybody that the whole theory for Langmuir and Green's was developed for OB stars, which are very luminous stars.
Yes.
Luminosity of 10% of Eddington. So even the classic Langmuir and Green's from stars are for systems which are relatively bright.
But
the the line driving is essential. It is not, you know, you have to overcome gravity.
No, no, sure, but
some other effects that will give you the help you to overcome gravity, but not entirely. You still need that extra thing that will get you over.
No debate. It's just that there's no O star that's anywhere near Eddington. There's no O star that's L roughly equal to LED.
But I think
even those don't come really that close.
Whether it's UV line driving and or continuum driving, actually this is where a calculation would show us how much does Wilt want.
Yeah.
So it's a quantitative question that can be answered by Daniel's group. They can make this spectral energy distribution, they can put that in, power a wind, then they can turn off the continuum driving, see how much the wind changes. And so this is the sort of calculation I'm really trying to motivate here. I want us to calculate what we can calculate.
So my comment was that I really try to motivate sometimes to read what has been already calculated.
Right.
Quick, yeah. I had one last quick thing, which is completely different. So I'm really intrigued by this idea that atomic physics is kind of the key thing, and that basically, as you put it, sort of disks go bad when you get into this regime where the UV opacities become high. What do you think is the difference then between a disk like this, let's say, and a disk in an accreting white dwarf, which has extremely similar peak temperatures and which, as far as we know, don't do that? Is it just a function of brightness?
Or? So I've also looked at this, because I thought because when I thought, if it's the UV region, obviously the CVs are the place to look. So I looked at their spectra and I thought, but they don't seem to be doing the same thing. And I have two possible answers for that. One possible answer is that black holes, of course, you can have this very strong X-ray region. And if it was connected at all with UV, then actually, because the ionizing environment is so different, then that would, again, break the scaling. But there's also, I was talking to Omar, and he said that because also in the cataclysmic variables, your disk is denser. Ooh, where did that go? Your disk is denser. So maybe actually if it was the scale height going up, maybe you're still dense enough that you still properly thermalize. Again, this is... Yeah, but this is a quantitative question, and people with disk models can do this. So people with disk models, which will include atomic capacities, which also include the disk instability. The temperature of 10 to the 4 Kelvin is kind of round here. The disk instability, you did the paper saying saying that the disk instability in AGN is is a local instability, not a global instability. What does that do for your disk structure? Does it stir it up? That's where maybe it goes convectively unstable. Does it get a large scale height? Alpha goes up. Someone calculate this. Maybe this isn't where the answer lies, but until we've done a calculation, we can't show that.
Good topics for discussion. Two quick questions, Deanna.
There's a lot of Seaforts now that have very good broadband X-ray spectra that do suggest the disk goes down to 1 RG.
I would challenge that.
Okay.
So the nice one that I saw recently, Ferrell 9, with a beautiful spectrum from New Star and XMM. It's kind of like this source in that it's got... it's a fairly extreme, lowish luminosity, quite hard X-ray spectrum. And one of the things we know from X-ray binaries is if you have a hard X-ray spectrum, it's actually very difficult to put the disk anywhere close, because your hard X-rays would illuminate the disk. Some reflect, but some thermalize, and the thermal emission comes back and cools the X-ray source. And so one of the reasons to make these truncated disk models in binaries is because you see very hard X-ray spectra, and it's very difficult to put the disk anywhere close. But then you get the ion lines saying, but there are broad ion lines. Yet with the new star data now, it's very clear that there's no strong reflection hump in there. So Giorgio Matt did this beautiful paper on Arakalian 120, where you can see very clearly there's no strong reflection bump, so you can't have a lot of reflection in there. But then they dug out a very small but very broad reflection component. But then when Tahir Yacoub fits data like this, that torus reflected spectrum, if you take it from a torus that's not infinitely optically thick but only has a column of 10 to the 24, that changes the shape in subtle ways that can completely remove the broad line component in objects like this, where it's a subtle thing. In those narrow line Seyfert ones, it can be very big and very dramatic, and I'm not talking about those. I think you were asking about these.
Yeah, something like 1365.
Yeah.
So, kind of a naive question. I was looking at the low frequency end of your disk fits, and it looked to me in some cases that they were very steep or curved. Are we seeing the outer edge of the disk there?
Yeah, I think we are sometimes.
So isn't that a kind of a free parameter in the modeling?
I can make it put it at the self-gravity radius, or I can let it go to wherever it wants. So normally it's not an issue, but for some, which one were you looking at? Let's find a better, where did we go? So here you're not seeing, this bend here isn't the outer radius. This bend is, the models include, they already include something about UV opacity, which is when you go from a disk with optical temperatures where hydrogen's not ionized, then you don't have much free electrons, so there's no scattering in the disk atmosphere itself. But when you go past the hydrogen ionization temperature, you then do have free electrons, and so you get a bit of scattering in the atmosphere, and so the color temperature correction changes, but it still comes out as roughly black body. The disk outer radius makes an impact down here. So if you start crawling down into the infrared, then you start to hit that. Yes.
Okay, we need to move on to the next segment. Thank you again.